We're speaking with Pete Seeger, and Pete, we're at the People's Music Network for Songs of Freedom and Struggle. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about how this group began?
Every year, about 150 or 200 people gather for a weekend of song swapping, and they discuss and learn from each other how to use music in schools, in churches, in unions, singing in the streets, singing with a family, singing in choruses, singing different kinds of music, gospel music, blues, Latin music, different kinds of instruments. It's a very informal organization. I can compare it to a convention of chefs all sampling each other's recipes. It's not a festival, although if you like music, you'll come here. Don't come here to hear your favorite song sung by your favorite singer. More often than not, people are testing out their new songs, whether they're professional musicians or amateur musicians. There's not a sharp line drawn here. There's some very amateurish musicians and some very special musicians.
How many years has it been going on?
About 20 years or more. Started by a fellow from Connecticut, Charlie King. He and I met backstage at a peace rally somewhere back during the Vietnam War. As we always say, let's get together and talk sometime, but we never do. So one day he sat down and said, I found a summer camp where we can get together for a weekend. Who can make it? 75 people showed up. This kind of thing is going on all across the country, you know. Small groups of people that are doing similar work get together occasionally to exchange ideas. And the success of the People's Music Network here gave rise to a Midwest People's Music Network, and in the Bay Area, San Francisco, they have a Freedom Song Network. Interesting, they use the word network, which implies that we may disagree on an awful lot of things, but nevertheless, we're working in the same field. Let's just keep in touch with each other. Whereas an organization is supposed to have a policy and pronunciamentos and so on.
All right, the correct line. A lot of people might say, hey, in this present climate in the mid-90s, that there's not a lot of activism, unions are in decline. Has that affected at all the enthusiasm of the singers and songwriters that come to this festival?
Oh, some people perhaps have given up. I would say there's more than ever, though. In fact, I know there's more than ever. There's thousands. Unions are in decline mainly because the old styles ways of working have not been changed. There's going to be a whole brand new generation of union leaders coming along who are going to realize that unions must become international. Business is international. Unions are going to have to become international. And they'll be multilingual. They'll have big arguments, but workers in the same industry in Africa and Asia and Latin America, as well as Europe and North America, will all be putting their heads together saying, now look, the only way we'll handle this problem is if we all cooperate closely.
During the 60s, people were focusing on issues like Vietnam and the civil rights movement. What are people focusing on now? Is there any couple of topics that seem to crop up at this festival for the last couple of years?
People often ask me that question. People say, what do you think is the most important thing to work on? I tell them, I think whatever is nearest to you. There was a biologist who said, René Dubos coined the phrase, think globally, act locally. He says, how can you save the world if you can't save the corner of it where you live? Don't travel to some glamorous place far off and think you're going to solve the world's problems there. Solve it right where you are. Don't run away from them. Running away from them is something which human beings have done for thousands of years. Poor people ran away from Europe to try and get away from the kings and the dukes that controlled Europe. And black people left Mississippi to try and find a better place to live up north. Now many of them are going back. They find that there's things they can do in the South they can't do in Harlem or in Detroit or Chicago. My guess is people will gradually realize that it's one crisis the human race faces. It's a crisis of poverty amidst plenty. There's no reason anybody in the world need be hungry or go without a home. And education, with one small fraction of the money spent and wasted on silly things like guns and bombs and fashion design and so on, there could be a college education for everybody in the world. We've got the technology to do it. You don't need a big campus to have a university. All you need is some computers and people who know how to teach others how to use them. So we got a crisis of poverty amidst plenty. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And the jobs are running away to Mexico. We've got a crisis of pollution, everybody knows, of chemists that are having a lot of fun discovering new chemicals and not paying any attention to which ones might be dangerous. And now most of us are walking around with small amounts of dioxin on our bodies. We breathe it in, we drink it in, it gets in the food, and the cancer rate is steadily going up, 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 up. And then when somebody close to you dies, you say, what could I have done to stop it? Here's what you can do. Start reading right now about the environmental crisis and realize that it's going to kill you and your children if you don't solve it. So it's a crisis of pollution. Of course, it's hard to know who to believe because the scientists get bought off. They're normal human beings, and when you offer them a good salary, they'll work for a businessman and come out with the numbers which think they can prove something. Figures don't lie, but liars can figure. It's a crisis, I would say, of alienation. The machine has made people feel like they're not so important anymore. The machine says to us, I can do it cheaper, I can do it better. My whole life has been spent trying to persuade people to do things themselves, not just as musicians, to make music themselves, but also to make things. I built my own house. I'm a do-it-yourself carpenter. My wife and I didn't have much money, but we raised a family in a house that cost $900. I went to a school where I learned how to use an axe up there in Connecticut near Hartford. I had 3,000 acres, and I got in the woods crew as a teenager. So I built a log cabin. It's a funny house. In a windy day, it's hard to keep it warm sometimes in winter, but we lived in it.
As far as the songs people are singing about at this festival, are they taking that to heart, the philosophy, act locally, or think globally, act locally? Are they singing about the incinerators back home? Are they talking about the tax problems or the runaway shops, things like that?
Some of them are, yeah. Of course, there's different ways of working. You wouldn't have to sing about those things necessarily to be involved in them. I was singing about the expansion of the nuclear power plant in Westchester County a few years ago. What was I singing? We shall not be moved. And I was singing, one of these nights about 12 o'clock, this old world's gonna reel and rock. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. These old spirituals are like a basketball backboard in my mind. They bounce back new ideas as life bounces new meanings against them. You don't need a lot of words often. But here, there's time for words and time for no words.
You were talking about technology before, as you know, being sort of a double-edged sword. Has technology, the synthesizers, the digital technology affected the character of folk music, in your opinion?
Tape recorders are part of the folk process now. Somebody learns a song off a tape, and next thing you know, they're making a new tape, swiping the other's melody slightly, and put some new words to it. That's the folk process. And computers will probably be part of the folk process, too. Keep in mind that folk music is a much broader term than most people think of it. There's as many kinds of folk music as there are folks. I mean it. There's thousands of kinds of folk music. Chinese folk music, many hundreds of kinds of Chinese folk music, hundreds of kinds of African folk music. And here in this country, we have very obviously dozens of kinds of African-American folk music. We have a rhythm from the Congo with a melody from Ireland, put together with the English language, which, as you know, is part German, part French, part Scandinavian, a little Arabic, and Lord knows what else.
As far as music and its connection with democracy and social change, how important, I mean, that you've dedicated your life to that, but how important is music to democracy and social change?
You can't prove a damn thing. Obviously, if I didn't think it was important, I wouldn't be still trying to sing or make up songs. I do know that through history, the rulers of every country have been quite particular about what kind of songs were permitted to be heard. There's an old Arab proverb: the king puts the poet off on his payroll and he cuts off the tongue of the poet. I think of that every time I get a job on TV. So, Plato is supposed to have said it's very dangerous for the wrong kind of music to be known among the people of the Republic. So the rulers think it's important, and I think people should think it's important too. Of course, as I say, you can't pin it down. And sometimes a very simple song will take on a vast meaning that the composer never intended it to have. There was a love song, which was the favorite song of a prince in Malaya. This was back just after World War II. And the prince was one of the leaders of the independence movement from Britain. Britain controlled Malaya at the time. And Britain put the prince under wraps. They exiled him, I think. But this song of his, it was a love song. Terambulan, da da di di da di di di, a lovely lilting melody. The whole country started singing it. The British had to ban it.
The Clearwater Project. I wonder if you'd talk about the initial goals that you started out with and if it's met your expectations. It's 25 years old this year, I believe, and you have a big commemoration coming up. I think you can explain what's going on this year. But as far as the Clearwater Project, whenever you talk about that.
Maybe your readers don't know. The Clearwater is a huge sailboat. Somebody seeing it on the Hudson say, gee, what millionaire owns that? And the answer is no millionaire owns it. It's owned by an organization that's trying to clean up the river, and it's called Clearwater. It started actually about 30 years ago. I had a little plastic bathtub of a boat I was sailing on the Hudson, and I looked down at the water I was sailing through and realized it was like sailing through a toilet bowl. Every time you flushed a toilet from New York to Albany, right, zoop, it went in the river. And I realized the truth of what Galbraith said: private affluence, public squalor. It's all through our country. And about that time, I had a friend who said, you know, Pete, they used to have sailboats on the river with a boom 70 feet long. I said, don't give me that. Never was a sailboat that big, except maybe an America's Cup racer. Oh, no, he says, I got a book about them. And he loaned me a dog-eared copy of a book written in 1908 by two middle-aged gents saying, we want to put down what we can remember of these boats because they were the most beautiful boat we ever knew and they will never be seen again. Steam had taken over. Barges were hauling the cargoes that used to be hauled by sloops. Originally Dutch boats. The word sloop is a Dutch word. Single-masted, very big sail, very shallow hull. They were river boats, not ocean boats. And they hauled bricks and Catskill, bluestone slate for the side rocks of New York, and Adirondack lumber. They built New York City in the 19th century. Well, I wrote a letter to my friend, why don't we build a replica of one? Stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning, 7 pages, close-spaced, single-spaced, typewritten letter, I'll never forget. And then I forgot about it. 4 months later, I meet him on the railroad station platform. "Pete, when are we going to build that boat?" I said, "What boat?" He says, "You wrote me a letter." Oh, I says, "That's as crazy as saying let's build a canoe and paddle to Tahiti." He said, "Well, I've been passing your letter up and down the commuter train. We got a couple dozen people want to get started." "Well," I said, "I don't know. If there's enough nuts, we might do it." And 3 years later, this huge sailboat was built. And we raised money in dollars and dimes, and then finally, in the end, reached a few millionaires, gave us some money, including some members of the Rockefeller family. But it was mainly musicians that raised most of the money. Not only me, but a lot of others. Don McLean, who wrote America Pie, was on our first crew. Jack Elliott, Gordon Bach of Maine. He was the best sailor, besides the captain. He became the first mate on the first crew. And the first crew will all be getting together in a couple of weeks, June 18th and 19th, on the campus of the Westchester Community College near Valhalla. Actually, take the train from Grand Central up to the North White Plains Station, and a shuttle bus will take you right to the festival. It's a great festival, believe me. A big community festival with, dozens of different kinds of stories and music and food and games. If you want to spend the day learning how to juggle or do something, they've got all sorts of things. It's a kind of a participation festival. If you'd like to sing in a chorus, we have a place just for singing. And you also can learn about the battle to clean up the Hudson, because it's still going on. We've only half cleaned it up. We've gotten rid of the toilet waste, but the problem now, as you know, is chemicals. They come from agricultural pesticides and herbicides, come from industry, from ordinary human beings emptying the crankcase oil and dumping it in the ground, and sooner or later it gets into the local stream and sooner or later into the river. There's a big job of education to do. The boat takes about 10 or 15,000 school kids out every year, 50 at a time. I get a 3 or 4 hour quick introduction to sailing and biology. They look through a microscope. "Hey, what's all those wiggly things?" "Well, that's called plankton. If there were no plankton in the river, there wouldn't be many fish. Plankton is for fish, what grass is for cows." Kids help steer the boat, help raise the huge sail. And we're very proud that after 25 years, we have made some progress. We hope anybody hearing my voice, come down to the Great Hudson River Revival, June 18th and 19th at Valhalla, New York. And you really will have a lot of fun. It's a family affair. No matter what kind of music you like, there's jazz there, there's Latin music, there's gospel, there's old-timey music, all sorts.
Your wife, Toshi, is the director of that, or one of the organizers of it, right?
Well, this is her last year working on it. She and I are both in our 70s now, and she's going to let some younger people do the job. She's one of the committee of 19, volunteers all, that plan. They work all year round planning this, the crafts, the food, the exhibits, the performers, and everything. And it's a difficult job. Trying to, just like politics, you want to reach everybody. You got to put together a coalition. History moves forward by coalitions. And we're very proud that Clearwater's, as I say, done half the job. But there's another lot still to be done. Curiously enough, our big job now is to see the riverbanks are not taken over by the rich. We want the shores to be accessible to everybody. And I guess there'll be compromises down in Yonkers. They're putting up some high-rises, but they're not putting up as many as they thought they were going to put. They would have walled off that city from the river. And in other cities, they're keeping the waterfront buildings down to be low-rises. But if somebody wasn't in there fighting for the river, it would be high-rise alley from the mountains to the sea. I'm convinced that if there's a human race here 100 years from now, and there may not be, you know, we don't straighten up and learn a few things. Ancient lessons taught us thousands of years ago, but people still don't listen to or don't act on them. if we don't learn them, there won't be a human race. This river will be clean as a whistle. Just won't be any people around to enjoy it. But if people keep plugging, it doesn't take a big organization. It just takes a few people putting their heads together and say, let's do something. It might be getting the kids involved in cleaning up the mess that other people have dropped. But how can we keep folks from dropping litter, broken glass all over the place? It's an education job. And kids have got to lead it. You can't depend on old folks like me to teach kids. We can help. But it's going to be the young folks that'll do the teaching. Of course, consider this. Every society has the task of facing an onrushing horde of barbarians, their own children.
Are you taking a commemorative ride on the Clearwater from Maine or something? I don't know.
No,
is
no,
there
no.
something like that going on?
Once a year I set foot on the boat just to say hello to the captain.
Yeah.
But the boat itself spends most of the April to November sailing up and down the Hudson and Long Island Sound and New York Bay. And then from November through March they stay in a small town called Saugerties, a little mill town. Up near Albany, and every weekend the volunteers come up and they sandpaper and they paint and do all sorts of little labor-intensive jobs so that that big wooden boat can sail the next season.
I wonder if you'd comment on the politics of the current era where George Bush introduced the term New World Order, and since the decline of the Soviet Union, certainly I think the discourse of this country is, well, since the era of Reagan, has, you know, swung to the right. And you have treatises like The End of History, you know, this is the end of human progress, this is as far as we're going to get, the triumph of capitalism and markets, and the U.S. style of democracy being attempted to be foisted on the people of Russia and Poland. What's your feeling about this new world order? Where do you think we're going? I mean, you've seen a lot in your day, and is this the end of history?
At age 75, I'm no longer as optimistic as I used to be. I felt certain, and perhaps if Franklin Roosevelt had stayed president, it would have happened. I felt certain that working people of East and West could find ways of working with each other, and instead of producing guns and bombs, we could produce education for the whole world. Well, I was wrong. Very wrong. And it may be that there will be no human race, because every year scientists make it easier and easier for us to destroy ourselves. The most recent thing is tinkering with the DNA molecule. They're inventing new bacteria. Think what Hitler would have done if he'd had that knowledge. Invent me a bacteria that will wipe out every dark-skinned person in the world. And then somebody else come invent a bacteria which will wipe out every white, light-skinned person in the world. Who's that going to leave? The world is full of power-hungry people, usually men, and they don't think far enough ahead. None of us are thinking far enough ahead. We rarely think of what's going to happen in the distant future. You say, I can't worry about that. I'm just trying to get by day to day. Well, if we don't do a little bit more than that, there won't be any human race here. I do think there's a chance, though, partly because people as a whole have realized that no one organization can do it. It's true, some people still hope that this or that church or this or that political party or this or that corporation will solve the world's problems. But I think it's going to be millions of little organizations all working more or less the same direction. What's that similar direction? I say, first of all, solving problems without having to kill each other. We disagree strongly, but we don't have to kill each other. And this is going to be a kind of world consensus until people that say, oh no, this can only be settled by guns, they'll be, you're out of your mind. You want to kill us all? Because guns no longer just kill soldiers. Bombs and other weapons wipe out cities, countries. And that's part of it. Part of it is also going to be, we got to work with everybody. May not like them, but you got to work with them. Different colored skin, different slant of eyes, different shaped noses, fat, thin, tall, short, different languages. And boy, do we disagree. Food. I love food, but I've traveled around the world. I know that what's a tasty dish to one people is, ugh, yeah, somebody else. Music. What's a good melody to one part of the world is a pain in the ear to somebody else. So we got to learn to laugh at our differences. That's part of it. I'd say, little by little, we'll all learn a few universal truths. And who knows? We might be surprised yet. When I meet people who are completely pessimistic, like Kurt Vonnegut, who writes one book after another, with the end of the world, end of the human race, I said, did you predict that Nixon would leave office the way he did? No. Did you predict that the Pentagon would have to leave Vietnam the way it did? Well, no. Did you predict the Berlin Wall would come down so peacefully? No, guess not. Well, if you could not predict those three things, how can you be positive that you're correct in predicting the end of the world? Because there, at least, were three things that very few people predicted. A few diehards kept hoping, and by gosh, they happened.
Pete, you have a career and written some world-famous songs. You're also blacklisted in the 50s for your political beliefs, and some people might say you sacrificed a lot for your political beliefs.
Yeah, nothing.
Well, I'm curious if you would do it all over again the way you did.
Oh, I've made an awful lot of mistakes, but by and large, I guess I'd do the same thing. Some people's lives were ruined by the blacklist, but I just kept sailing through it. I sang in schools and colleges, and I sang whatever I thought was appropriate. I'm against censors, but I think if there's a human race here 100 years from now, it's because everybody in the world will realize we all got to be our own censors. We got to decide for ourselves what is appropriate or not appropriate to say or do. And incidentally, I hate the word career. That implies you're looking after fame and fortune. Those are two of the silliest things to aim at. I have had a happy life, thanks to an absolutely extraordinary person I'm married to, and having a good family, brothers and sisters and parents when they were alive who stuck by me no matter what I did. And I had a lot of friends who stuck by me no matter what I did, still do. I'm about the luckiest musician I know. I'm still singing here and there, even though I don't have much voice left. My grandson sings with me.
What's your most proud accomplishment? I mean, as I said, some incredible songs like Where Have All the Flowers Gone and If I Had a Hammer, songs known and sung around the world. But is there any one song or one thing you've done that you're most proud of?
One thing? Well, this July, my wife and I will celebrate our 51st year together. If you had one thing, that'd be it.
Beautiful. Any final thing you'd like to say about the state of the world and the future, as far as you see it, and maybe the place of song in that world?
Well, you might consider trying to answer the question on your radio, when should people not listen to the radio? I put in my banjo book, when not to play the banjo. I'm really an author more than a performer. I've written a batch of books. My first one was How to Pick the Five-String Banjo, How to Play the Five-String Banjo. The most recent one is a collection of songs called Where Have All the Flowers Gone? A Singer's Stories, Songs, Seeds, Robberies.